condemned the strike and stressed the need to uphold international law and protect media institutions in times of conflict.
Bombs and missiles cannot defeat the truth. The truth always prevails. What we witness here today is the undeniable truth of what happened.
The scenes we see here are evidence of Zionist atrocities against Iran, an effort to silence the truth. We are here to stand in solidarity with the Iranian people.
This is really unexpected for us to see the level of destruction. You know, we are told that this building was attacked repeatedly, total 11 times. But the first time when it was attacked, journalists were inside and they are running live programs. So this is totally unacceptable. Even in war field, journalists are protected.
Even in the harshest wars, journalists should never be targeted. This strike happened during a live broadcast. We strongly condemn this act of aggression.
Walking through Ashfield hallways and past burnt-out studios where just weeks ago millions tuned in for the news, anchor Sahar Imami gives a first-hand account of the June 15th attack.
I was in the studio from early morning, reporting on the Israeli attacks and updating our viewers. Around 6:30 p.m., while we were live on air, the strike happened. We knew it was dangerous, but my colleagues and I in the control room chose to stay, to report every last moment so the world could see the truth.
Cameras captured the chaos with the network's news host and director staying at their posts, determined to keep the broadcast alive until the building went dark. Their courage has become a symbol of Iranian media resistance.
We were live on national TV, fully aware of the risks, but we had a mission to inform. Even under threat, we did not leave. We stayed, determined to fulfill our duty as journalists.
The head of Iran's national broadcaster says the glass building will soon be rebuilt and resume its role as a hub for journalism, stressing that the destruction only reveals Israel's desperation and the true colors of its supporters. In the charred remains of this studio, what we witness is Iranian resilience that endures despite flagrant violations of the Geneva Conventions and a direct attack on the press. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
More devastation across the Gaza Strip as Israeli military presses ahead with its air and artillery attacks killing and wounding more Palestinians. The Israeli warplanes carried out more than 100 airstrikes across Gaza in the past 24 hours. One of the attacks near an aid center northwest of Rafah killed at least two people and left many others wounded. In Khan Yunis, an Israeli drone strike on a tent housing the displaced people killed one and injured several Palestinians. Israeli forces also demolished several houses in the Saudi neighborhood west of Rafah. Palestinian medical sources say at least 12 Gazans have been killed since dawn on Monday. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in October 2023, over 58,000 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 138,000 others wounded, most of them women and children. Let us now cross over to Gaza City and get an update from our correspondent Garda Ibrahim. Garda, over to you.
The Israeli genocide, as you mentioned, continues, and the massacres are relentless, as you mentioned before. Since the dawn until now, at least 25 Palestinians were killed in different airstrikes across the Gaza Strip. And the most brutal of these airstrikes targeted a group of people in As-Saftawi area that resulted in the killing of five of the same family, Subah family. Another airstrike targeted Al-Shaja'iyah that resulted in the killing of three. Another airstrike also targeted Al-Nusayra refugee camp in the middle of Al-Nusayra, the densely populated area that targeted a queue for water distribution and resulted in the killing of one and the injuries of many injuries around the people who were gathering to get this the water from the aid distribution point. So the Israeli brutality has no limits, and it is relentlessly bounding the Gaza Strip. So this is happening amidst a very dire humanitarian situation and a very catastrophic situation that is resulted from the Israeli blockade that has been imposed on the Gaza Strip for more than 5 months in a row now, that deprives the people all the medical supplies and the aid, the food and the fuel as well. Three injuries succumbed to the wounds this morning and died as a result of the lack of medications and the lack of the medical supplies into the Gaza Strip, and that highlights the catastrophic situation the hospitals are struggling amidst, and the catastrophic situation of the hospitals in the Gaza Strip as a result of this ban and as a result of this Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip. The situation in Gaza remains really tense as the Israeli occupation army announced this morning that in the past 24 hours it has targeted 100 targets, and following up these targets, you can without any effort of investigation, you see that none of these is a strategic target, and none of these targets were actually a military site or a military target. They were all children, they were all gatherings of people in civilian homes, civilian buildings, and the latest of these attacks was a queue for water distribution, and the one before was a group of people in a family home, a Sabah family in Asaftawi area.
Right, thank you, Gada, for the update. I hope we'll have better news. But one quick question. Can you tell me about the negotiations that have stalled on the peace and the ceasefire between Gaza, Hamas and Israel?
Talking about the negotiations, the Israeli occupation until now keeps like hindering the negotiations by suggesting a humanitarian city in the city of Rafah near to the border, to the Egypt border crossing, and that actually is a very critical point, and that could actually cause the negotiations to fall apart, because Hamas is committed to end the war. However, the Israeli occupation is not committed to ending the war, and it is right. Actually committed to building a humanitarian city near the Egypt border crossing. This is actually Hamas previously showed flexibility in the towards the negotiations and showed flexibility in dealing with the negotiations. However, the Israeli occupation keeps hindering and keeps trying to put obstacles to prolong the war and to prolong the Israeli massacres in the Gaza Strip.
Right, thank you, Gada. So no more development on that. Gada Ibrahim, thank you for the update, joining us from Gaza City. Two UN agencies have raised a serious alarm about severe malnutrition threatening the lives of thousands of children in Gaza amid the ongoing Israeli blockade of the territory. The United Nations Children's Fund said over 5,800 children were diagnosed with malnutrition in June alone, more than 1,000 of whom suffered from severe acute malnutrition. It described the situation as a child survival emergency, urging rapid aid delivery to the people of Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees also warned of a sharp rise in malnutrition cases in Gaza, particularly among children and other vulnerable groups. UNRWA said it has recorded a significant surge in malnutrition cases since the tightening of the Israeli blockade in March. It called for global efforts to ensure the delivery of life-saving supplies and end the worsening humanitarian crisis. According to Palestinian health officials, malnutrition has claimed the lives of at least 67 children, while over 650,000 children under the age of 5 are at immediate risk of acute malnutrition. An Israeli plan to relocate Gaza's population to a closed zone near the Egyptian border has drawn sharp condemnations from both Palestinians and the international community. The plan was unveiled last Monday by Israel's Minister of Military Affairs. It envisions building a closed zone in southern Gaza during a potential 60-day ceasefire in the territory, which is currently under negotiation in Qatar. According to Israel, Gaza's entire population of over 2 million people will be eventually displaced to the so-called humanitarian city. In response, Hamas has rejected the plan, calling it a preparation for forcibly displacing Palestinians to Egypt or other countries. The Palestinian Authority also dismissed the plan, saying it has nothing to do with humanity. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees condemned the idea as a massive concentration camp for Palestinians. The plan is also under fire in Israel. On Friday, a group of 16 Israeli law scholars warned in a letter to the regime officials that the plan could amount to a war crime. Political analyst Jim Kavanagh joined us earlier to discuss the impact of Israel's relocation plan on the livelihood of Palestinians in Gaza. Here's what he had to say.
You are absolutely correct. This is a cruel, gratuitous cruelty. It's absurd that anybody would ever suggest it in 2025. Even as you say, Israeli scholars are against it. I saw former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was saying, well, this could be ethnic cleansing. Well, you think so? That's exactly what it is. But this is the plan all along, to kill and expel the Palestinians from Gaza. Okay, this humanitarian city is a concentration camp. They are saying people who don't go into the city are fair game. They're going to be killed because they're going to be presumed terrorists, et cetera, if they're not in the city. Once they get in the city, they cannot leave except by, you know, leaving forever and with no permission to come back. And they're going to create a situation where it's going to be impossible for all those people to live anyway. They're going to have the same kind of nonsense they have with these food distribution networks, where you're not going to get any food. You're going to have to be running through gunfire to get it. And people are going to want to leave. That's what they're going to do. People want an end to the being shot at, and they want an end to starving. They want an end to their doctors and sons and daughters and mothers and fathers being killed. And, you know, so they're going to offer them the cheese to go inside the trap, and they'll be in that trap. And frankly, they're going to do it.
The United States President Donald Trump has announced that Washington will send Patriot air defense systems to Ukraine, describing it as a business move.
But we basically are going to send them various pieces of very sophisticated military, and they're going to pay us 100% for them. And that's the way we want it. We're in for about $350 billion. Europe is in for $100 billion. That's a lot of money, $100. But they should be in actually for more than us. The European Union is paying for it. We're not paying anything for it. But we will send it. It'll be business for us, and we will send them Patriots.
Trump's comments come after he confirmed last week that his administration had decided to sell weapons to NATO allies in Europe, who will then supply them to Kiev. This is while the White House had earlier this month announced that it would pause some arms deliveries to Kiev. Meanwhile, Russian forces have intensified airstrikes on Ukrainian military industrial sites. The Russian military says it has targeted key Ukrainian defense facilities, destructing two Patriot missile launchers and a radar station. As the Russia-Ukraine war enters its fourth year, U.S.-led negotiations have so far yielded no results to end the fighting. And that's it from me today. Goodbye from me, Behman Ray. Until next time.
In the early hours of June 13th, an unprovoked and shocking escalation shook West Asia. With the backing of the United States, Israel launched a coordinated assault on Iranian territory, striking residential neighborhoods in Tehran, military facilities, and most provocatively, nuclear sites in Natanz and Isfahan. The attack marked the beginning of a 12-day war that would alter regional geopolitics and leave both aggressors, Israel and the U.S., scrambling to reframe a campaign that failed to meet its strategic goals. The first day was particularly deadly for Iran. Not only did it lose top generals and nuclear scientists, but the country was forced to react while it was on the verge of entering the sixth round of nuclear talks with the U.S. The pretense of diplomacy was shattered by bombs. By nightfall on June 13th, Iran responded with waves of drone and missile strikes, targeting Israeli military and intelligence sites deep inside the occupied territories. While American officials initially distanced themselves, claiming Israel had acted independently, their true role became clear when on June 22nd, the U.S. directly struck nuclear facilities in Natanz, Isfahan, and Fordo, deploying bunker-busting munitions designed to target Iran's most secure underground enrichment sites. Washington framed this as an effort to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, a claim hollowed by their own intelligence findings and IAEA reports just weeks earlier, confirming Iran had no current weaponization plans. In reality, the dual assault by Israel and the U.S. appeared to have a different goal: regime change. Western media floated the son of the deposed Shah as a government-in-waiting, complete with a televised day-after plan. Assassinations of key IRGC commanders and pressure on military officers to defect revealed the extent of this ambition. But instead of toppling the Islamic Republic, these efforts sparked a wave of national unity across Iran. Civilians rallied behind the leader of the revolution, not out of blind loyalty, but because they viewed the attacks as targeting Iran itself, not just its leadership. The scope of Iran's retaliation was devastating and unprecedented. For 12 continuous days, Israeli cities like Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Be'er Sheva were hit repeatedly. The famed Iron Dome was overwhelmed. According to Hebrew media, the financial and infrastructural damage sustained in this short span matched 20 months of war in Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon. A third of Tel Aviv was reportedly in ruins. For the first time in decades, Israeli settlers fled en masse, smuggling themselves out through Cyprus and Egypt as the government restricted departures. Iran suffered serious losses. Over 600 lives, including civilians, military personnel, and nuclear scientists, but paradoxically gained political capital. Its portrayal as a victim of premeditated aggression, particularly as it was preparing for diplomacy, resonated internationally. Russia openly criticized the IAEA's bias and the reckless nature of U.S.-Israeli strikes. Foreign Minister Lavrov underscored how no evidence existed that Iran was preparing to attack Israel, contrary to the narratives pushed in Western capitals. In response to what it deemed as the IAEA's complicity, the Iranian Majlis voted to suspend cooperation with the nuclear watchdog. Inspectors would only be allowed into Iran if the security of nuclear facilities was guaranteed, a prerogative now tightly guarded by Iran's Supreme National Security Council. This marked a significant shift. Iran no longer saw benefit in cooperating with institutions it viewed as compromised. Even more telling was Iran's rapid internal control. Over 700 individuals were arrested for espionage or collaboration with Israel, and a few were executed for smuggling equipment used in assassinations. These actions reflected Iran's belief that the war extended beyond military engagement. It was existential, targeting its sovereignty and survival. Back in Washington, Trump faced political blowback. His decision to attack Iran mid-negotiation and its threats to assassinate Iranian leaders alienated global partners. Iran's retaliatory strike on the U.S. base in Qatar, the largest American base in West Asia, was a direct humiliation. This followed a precedent set in 2020 when Iran bombed al-Assad base in Iraq after Trump's order to assassinate General Qasem Soleimani. Once again, American military might was exposed as vulnerable. Despite his bluster, Trump found himself politically cornered. His approval rating dropped to 41%, with key voters questioning why he reignited conflict when his platform had promised disengagement from wars in Ukraine and Gaza. Simultaneously, Trump attempted to soften his stance, offering prayers for Iran and hinting at a new diplomatic deal. It was a staggering reversal. In Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu claimed victory, insisting the war had achieved its objectives, decapitating Iran's nuclear program and fostering regime change. But both goals collapsed under scrutiny. The nuclear decapitation failed outright. Iran successfully moved 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium from Fordo before the strikes. The U.S. intelligence assessment later admitted that the operation only set Iran's program back by a few months, contradicting Trump's claims of obliteration. Israeli assessments were even more optimistic, claiming delays of years. Yet, with key facilities intact and materials secured, Iran retains the ability to rebuild and even accelerate its program. Its withdrawal from IAEA cooperation suggests it might do just that. Regime change? Not only did it not occur, but it also backfired spectacularly. The assassinations, rather than demoralizing Iran's elite forces, galvanized public opinion. Even Iranians opposed to the regime found themselves siding with the IRGC, not out of newfound loyalty, but out of patriotic duty. They saw a foreign war against Iran itself. Israel's symbolic attacks on Evin Prison, the Doomsday Clock, and the IRIB broadcaster only added to the perception that this was a war to destroy the Iranian nation, not liberate it. The The war left Israel isolated, vulnerable, and weakened in regional and global perception. The economic cost was staggering. The myth of Israeli invincibility cracked as Iranian missiles reached deep into its heartland. The famed anti-missile system ran low on interceptors. The military failed to neutralize Iran's retaliation, and Netanyahu's political image suffered, not from lack of aggression, but from strategic failure. In Washington, Trump's credibility took a massive hit. His erratic shift from war threats to peace offers cast doubt on any future negotiations. Allies in Europe privately distanced themselves from U.S. policy, while regional actors in the Persian Gulf grew anxious. Trump did not unite the world behind Israel. If anything, his reckless approach widened divides and hardened opposition. At the core of this war lies a long-standing delusion that external force can impose regime change in Iran or destroy its nuclear capabilities permanently. Israel and the U.S. misread Iran's domestic resilience. They believed that economic strain and internal dissent would translate into regime collapse under military pressure. But history has repeatedly shown that Iranians unite in times of national crisis, from the Iran-Iraq war to the economic war and sanctions era. This latest war only reinforced that pattern. The second failure lies in underestimating Iran's nuclear resilience. Its program is not centralized in one facility, but is widely dispersed, deeply buried, and increasingly indigenous. The relocation of enriched uranium ahead of the strikes showed a level of strategic foresight that eluded both Tel Aviv and Washington. Moreover, Iran's technological capacity means that even severe damage can be repaired and often rebuilt better. Finally, the war proved that military solutions cannot replace diplomacy. Bombs cannot dismantle ideals or erase national will. Iran's response was calculated, precise, and avoided escalation beyond what was necessary. Yet it was devastating enough to shake the very foundations of Israeli and American confidence in their technological dominance. The 12-day war between Iran and Israel, backed by the United States, exposed the limits of military power and the enduring strength of political will. Far from collapsing, Iran emerged bruised but emboldened, internationally vindicated, domestically united, and militarily validated. Israel suffered a psychological and material blow unlike anything in its modern history. The United States, once a hegemon in the region, now finds itself distrusted, its leadership viewed as reckless and inconsistent. As the dust settles and both sides enter a tense pause, one thing is clear. Wars born of hubris rarely achieve their intended outcomes. The pursuit of regime change and the dream of a nuclear-free Iran, enforced by force, may have finally run their course. What replaces it, diplomacy, deterrence, or further confrontation, will shape the region for years to come.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, I will start off this Spotlight with words from former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, which are quite apropos. He said that it may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal. Well, perhaps some of the U.S.'s closest allies can definitely agree with Kissinger's assessment, as Washington is putting major tariffs on country after country, from Japan and South Korea to the EU, Mexico, and Canada. None have been exempted. But why? And will this make America great again, as U.S. President Trump says, or will it expedite the U.S.'s isolation? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Bradenton. And Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me. Let me start this off with Larry. I mean, the U.S. President has announced a new tariffs threats to take place from August the 1st. Actually, he announced it in a post on Truth Social. Let's start from here. I mean, what message does Trump want to send by announcing these tariffs on social media?
Being a bully, being, you know, using threats instead of diplomacy. It really is terribly counterproductive. And Trump is, you know, he's succeeded so far this year in building up a reputation as a guy who will make a lot of threats, but doesn't always follow through on them. You know, we saw that in particular, some of his comments about Gaza, and he threatened Hamas that there'd be hell to pay. He did that two or three times. So now with the tariffs, he has... he's turned it into a form of sanctions. And as you correctly noted, he's using it against his friends, you know, or what should be our friends. Brazil has always been close to the United States. And, you know, there was some suspicion that Lula and his chairmanship of BRICS for this year would be the one most likely to be the weakest. It would cave in to U.S. pressure. Now Trump in a, you know, one day succeeded in flipping Lula into, you know, just complete outrage over the U.S. wanting to impose sanctions on Brazil for internal political and judicial decisions. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, well, Gilbert, I mean, your thoughts. The trade deficit, according to Trump, this is what he says. The trade deficit is a major threat to the U.S. economy and indeed U.S. national interests. Your thoughts.
So Trump has put out many justifications, some of them contradictory, changing from day to day. But I never follow closely what he says. I follow where his feet are pointed, what he does. And I agree with Larry Johnson that this is about sanctions, only I don't agree in which direction they're faced. These are sanctions directed against the United States. There was a lot of talk going back several years that Donald Trump had a bromance with Vladimir Putin, that he was saw in him a fellow authoritarian. I'm speaking now of remarks about Trump that were made by his enemies, of whom there are many, and that this was the reason for the outreach to Trump, to Putin, coming from Mr. Trump. I never agreed with any of that, certainly not a kinship among authoritarians or anti-democratic forces. That is utter nonsense. But what I do believe that Mr. Trump has had a long period of envy towards Mr. Putin. Make America great again? Well, he has to look across the ocean to Moscow, and Mr. Putin has definitely used his 20 years in office to make Russia great again. So, but how did he do it? In large part, thanks to, in the last 5 years, thanks to the sanctions, or going back to 2014, when the first severely punitive sanctions were imposed on by the United States, and then followed up by the Europeans with a delay of several months. These sanctions created an import replacement program. It created a reindustrialization program in Russia. And that is precisely what Mr. Trump has envied enormously in Russia. And these tariffs, so-called tariffs, are not tariffs directed against anybody. They are sanctions directed against the United States. Its intent is to achieve in the United States what Mr. Putin has achieved by sanctions.
Well, why do you say this is actually sanctions against the U.S.? Can you expand on that, Gilbert?
Well, this makes it difficult, if not impossible, to import a great many products that the United States can and should be producing at home. The whole globalization program is something that Mr. Trump has despised. The alliance system is something that Mr. Trump has criticized severely going back decades. There's nothing new in this. He is a believer in an industrially powerful United States.
Okay.
He is a believer that American military strength will be founded on production at home. And frankly, I think he's dead right.
Okay, well, Larry, I mean, Trump says that he will impose 30% tariffs on the EU, which is the U.S.'s biggest trading partner. Let's look at that side of things. First of all, why? And let's look at the effects, first on people living in the EU and also on regular American citizens. Your thoughts?
Well, the EU is not the U.S. biggest trading partner. The top three are China, Canada, and Mexico. Candidly, there's very little the United States needs out of the EU. They may want to have the EU as a market for U.S. products, but this entire tariff regime, it's backfiring, and we haven't yet seen the effects of it. I think there was an expectation that when he first announced the tariffs across the board, that you're going to see immediate economic repercussions. Because you haven't seen inflation surge in the United States, for example, you got several of the Trump advisors taking a victory lap, say, congratulating themselves. But I've got a neighbor down the street from me who manufactures sports equipment, baseball bats, hockey sticks, and lacrosse sticks. And he was a Trump supporter. And he was lamenting to me on the 4th of July get-together at his house that he goes, Trump's killing me with these tariffs. He says, I've just had to come up with $150,000 for the latest shipment. He said, we didn't budget for that. And so he started talking about he's going to have to factor in price hikes on his sports equipment. And then he commented, you know, and my business is slowing down. Now, he's what I'd call a small to middle-sized business. Multiply that across the United States. Then you've got the other effect of, you know, Trump wanting to say he's going to benefit farmers, except our farmers used to have a significant portion of the market in China where they would provide corn, soybeans, wheat. Well, guess where China is buying that from now? Brazil and Russia. And the U.S. has lost that market share. So that's where I think, you know, another dimension of what Gil was talking about, that it's actually ends up sanctioning the United States, but instead of having that desired effect to promote domestic industry, it's actually creating some incentives and dynamics that are going to make it even more impossible for people to actually come here and build and reindustrialize.
Well, I mean, Larry, wouldn't Trump or shouldn't he have known the effects? We were talking about, for example, small businesses, medium businesses, and even larger businesses, that obviously if you're going to put this type of tariffs on countries, then it's going to be reciprocated to a certain degree, and
right.
It's going to be much more costly for the average American consumer.
In Trump world, the narcissist that he is, what he says is the best, it's the smartest, it's the biggest, it's the most wonderful. How can you question him? I admit I had voted for the guy over Kamala Harris, but I'm regretting it now. He is, his mental state, his decision making is very, very erratic. And there is no strategy. He's not a chess player. Never has been. You know, casinos and golf, okay? Sort of someone who's going to go to the gaming table and take a chance without thinking it through. Like a good chess player, they're thinking through three or four or five moves ahead. That's not Trump. And he's just throwing it at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Okay, well, Gilbert, let's look at Mexico. Now, that side of things, another country, 30% tariffs that have been announced. Now, Mexico, at the beginning of the second term of Trump, basically had said that they would cooperate with him and for basically the U.S. not to increase the tariffs. And the Mexicans have been cooperating with the United States, have extradited many leaders of drug cartels. However, now all of a sudden, again, Trump has come back and said that 30% tariffs would definitely be thrown against Mexico now. I mean, why?
Well, look across the border where the U.S. car makers are manufacturing a large part of their production. And I think he would like that to end. And if he changes the rule of the game, which is a 30% across-the-board tariff, and I think even higher the tariffs on car parts and so forth, then yes, the American car manufacturers will have to completely rethink their game. And they will be producing more in the States. I don't think it's essential that there be foreign invested in production facilities in the States. As if the United States is unable to raise capital at home for industrial projects. So I think that he is saying many things which are totally irrelevant to his intention. His intention is to cut back sharply on American imports and to make it essential that these products, which can and should be produced in the United States, are produced there. There were so many incentives given to American multinationals, largely in the area of taxes, which encouraged them to manufacture abroad and to retain their earnings abroad. Mr. Trump is undoing all of that, and I don't agree that he has no concept of what he wants, because what he's doing, he's wanted to do for 30 years. So it isn't just a matter of recent whim. What is whim is how he explains it to the public, and he will say anything, changing day to day, to keep all of his enemies off balance. But what he wants fundamentally is a reindustrialization, because the products are too expensive and unattractive when imported under these tariffs.
Well, what about that, Larry, what Gilbert just said? He wants reindustrialization. Is that going to happen? Do you see the United States going in that direction?
No. I agree that that's what he wants. And you know, let me put it, I give you a personal context for this. Let me take you back 52 years ago when I graduated from high school. At that time, my father worked at a steel mill, Armco Steel. My friend's father worked at Standard Oil or at Bendix Corporation or at General Motors. So most of the people in my high school class, most of them were working in factories. They were manufacturing. They were building things. We had very few sons and daughters of lawyers or doctors or insurance salesmen. The majority were industry. Go back today, all of those industries are gone from my hometown, Independence, Missouri, which was where Harry Truman was from. And that has taken place across the United States. So when you get that kind of deindustrialization, and then you compound it by the point about what Putin did starting 25 years ago, was he didn't invest in military in order to go out and invade other countries and run up, you know, spend literally $1 trillion in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and Serbia and Panama. He stayed at home and invested in the infrastructure there in Russia, which is why today Russia is magnificent, absolutely magnificent. I was knocked over by my visits there. And you don't see that in the United States. You come into to New York City, it's a trash heap. Philadelphia, even Washington, D.C., you know, they started to clean the homeless out of the Union Station. But again, it's a nice dream to have, but I don't think they've got the practical resources in place at the very time when the rest of the global South has said, we're done with being bullied by the United States. We're going to set up our own financial system where we don't have to be under the threat of sanctions and bullying.
Well, speaking of bullying, I mean, Gilbert, basically what countries have to do now, those who are supposed to be facing these tariffs, either they have to allow the U.S. greater access to their markets, or they're going to face major tariffs. Now, the U.K. has agreed to give Washington greater access to its markets. That's the tariffs so far there. Against London are only 10%. Your thoughts about this, and what does that mean for a country in general that they would have to basically open up their markets or, you know, pay a major price? I mean, your overall assessment of this.
I don't think they will open their markets, and I think they will pay a major price. But that is the new world order. Just to comment on timelines, I think that that my colleague Larry is looking at this in a kind of typical business quarter to quarter. I think Mr. Trump is looking at this for the duration of his time in office. He is in a unique position. He cannot run again for presidency, and so he can do something that will be, in the short term, extremely unpopular without facing the consequences of continuing in office. He's doing this for the good of the country as he sees it. Whether that will work out or not just has to be considered. But let's look at Mr. Putin's success. It took him 5 years. The immediate impact of the sanctions on Russia was very harsh. There was inflation, very sharp inflation. There was cut back in spending power of population. I had this in my notes from 2015. The miracle didn't happen at once. And to expect that Mr. Trump from 1 month to the next is going to reindustrialize America is, of course, untrue and impossible. But over 5 years, he can. Mr. Putin did this over 5 years, starting in 2014. Well, more than that, 10 years. You don't do this at once, but you have to get started.
Okay, so you disagree. Disagree with Larry, or Larry disagrees with your assessment of basically.
I don't think we're necessarily in disagreement. Because I'm not suggesting that they could reindustrialize in, you know, a quarter to quarter. The United States faces some very significant problems, and Trump's approach to it. I used to think a little bit like Gil does, as far as that maybe Trump had a broader plan in mind and was actually thinking ahead, but. I've got the benefit of a very close associate of mine who's been in meetings with Trump. I mean, we're not talking with 100 people. We're talking 3 or 4 people on a particular issue, 6 times in the last 18 months. And my last conversation with him, he pointed out, he says, Trump's deteriorated significantly. So he's mentally not what he was even 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And you see that a little bit. And if you saw the other day when he was being questioned about who made the decision to suspend sending weapons to Kiev, he goes, you know, I don't know. What do you know? And then the next day the reporter said, well, have you found out who made that decision? Well, I make all the decisions. I know what's going on, and I didn't make that decision. It's just when you're hearing somebody talk like that, that is non sequiturs, then you've got to be concerned that when it comes to the economic policy, that they're not really thinking it through, because instead of reducing the deficit and reducing the spending, they're jacked up defense spending to $1 trillion from $870 billion, and the budget has gone, you know, they've expanded it, so they're not, they're just, you know, they're continuing to spend recklessly. And so that's why I say I don't think, you know, he may have these broad objectives in mind, but he's not taking the fundamental steps to get there, I don't think.
I mean, what does this mean, Gilbert? Is it just all Trump? I mean, obviously he has advisors. I mean, what's going on here? Because we're just talking back and forth and really not even saying the United States, but we're saying Trump. Has the United States deteriorated to that degree that basically it's a one-man show, that he's making the decisions? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, Larry referred to his narcissism, and I fully agree. He would like us to think that it's a one-man show, although that isn't a very good thing in general to present to serious thinking people. He has, of course, a team. He is not running this by himself. As regards his nonsensical and contradictory statements to the press, I look at a bigger issue. He has nothing but contempt for American journalists, and with good reason. When you look at Fox News, when you look at CNN, why shouldn't he have contempt for any of the journalists who push a microphone in front of his face? So he'll say anything, however nonsensical, to show this contempt. But that does not mean that he is mentally unbalanced or has mentally deteriorated. I don't know. I agree with Elon Musk on his big, beautiful bill. I am not a worshiper of Mr. Trump, but I do see the concept behind what he's doing, even if it's explained in the most confusing, intentionally confusing way. There is a logic to it. I don't know if it'll succeed. I do know one thing. There is going to be substantial economic pain in the States as a result of his tariff policy. We haven't begun to see it. Here I agree completely with Larry Johnson. How he will weather that storm remains to be seen.
Well, Larry, let's look at the French side of things now, because we also know the EU also been hit with 30% tariffs now. French President Emmanuel Macron said the EU must reciprocate and respond in kind. You think that's likely to happen?
This kind of mutual self-destruction. If I could see the Russians, they're going out and they're buying big bags of popcorn. And they're sitting back in their chair and they're eating and just enjoying the spectacle of watching the United States and Europe consume each other. This kind of foolishness at a time when Europe and the United States combined, as Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, observed a couple of months back, they cannot match Russia's production on a whole variety of issues. In particular, he's referring to artillery shells, saying that Russia produces more in 3 months than Europe and the United States do in an entire year. And that's absolutely correct. So to the extent that the French wants to start jacking up tariffs on the United States and vice versa, that all that does is hurts the economies of each of those countries. This doesn't make people wealthier. It makes them overall poorer. So this is it may bring a few more dollars into the governments, but the governments across the board, frankly, are bankrupt. None of them are experiencing any kind of growth in Europe right now. You know, they're basically stagnated. So and Gil's right that this, you know, when he talks about the pain that's going to come, I don't think the folks in the West are prepared for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also know, Gilbert, that Trump has said 35% tariffs for Canada. Now, the Canadians are saying they're going to diversify trade and turn towards the EU. Your thoughts, as Washington goes more towards protectionism, I mean, do you think that we're going to see more of these allied countries look in a different direction? And your overall assessment of what that means for the United States itself?
Well, they will look in different directions, and that's all they're going to do is look. It's one thing to say, being inside a major international corporation, you understand at once that the idea of finding new markets for your company's products is an idea that takes time to realize. It doesn't go from month to month. This takes years. And so the notion that the Canadians will switch over to Europe, well, it's a very good thing for their prime minister to tell his electors, his voters. But it is in terms of the shores of a whole Canadian is unrealizable in the immediate future. And the country, Canada, will suffer tremendously from what Mr. Trump is doing. But he doesn't care. His point is America does not need and should not have the alliances that it has today, on which it is too dependent. It has deprived the United States of well-paying manufacturing jobs that it has exported. And Mr. Trump wants to undo that, although it's a lot of pain, and he may not survive politically when the cost comes. As for the Europeans, well, the American component is not that big a part of their economy. So the sectors will be hit. The French wine producers, or otherwise are in crisis quite without this issue, will suffer enormously. Now, the other side of the equation we haven't addressed is on the United States. Mr. Trump introduced his tariffs, saying that he wanted to rebalance American trade. Of course, that's not going to happen. On the contrary, as Larry Johnson pointed out with respect to soybeans and wheat and other agricultural commodities, Americans are going to be hit hard by their usual export markets,
okay,
that who turned their back on it. So there's a lot of pain in many areas. It's too early to predict how this will play out.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Brandenton, Florida, and Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels, Belgium. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Allah, 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 Allah,
Ya Rabbi,
Allah, Allah,
Ya Rabbi,
Allah, Allah, Allah.
In the night they will stand and cry in hope and in fear. Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
Allah.
जैसे तेरे और शब्द